your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay. Charlotte, you're doing great, huh? Everything going okay?
Fantastic, George. Thanks for asking.
Boy, we've got a lot going on here. We're going to play a number of clips, five or six clips today, and we're going to be making comments and then expanding our thoughts a little bit on these different things. We've got Joseph Stiglitz. We've got Blackwater, former founder of Blackwater. We've got Wesley Clark going to say a few words. We've got the Republican Gabbard. And then we're going to end with Nikki Haley, and then we're going to talk about color revolutions. And we've got a full plate here today. And we're going to start off with a clip here by Joseph Stiglitz, okay? And what he was, he attended the World Economic Forum recently that takes place annually in Davos, Switzerland, usually towards the end of January. This year it was the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th. And he talks about a cashless society. And boy, we're not for that. What do you think, Charlotte? What about cashless society?
Well, they're talking about demonetization, right?
Right. Well, they're talking about taking out all cash and going to strictly bank accounts with credit cards or debit cards, and that's ultimate slavery. Yeah.
What? Yeah, but you might not hear it under the word cashless. You might hear demonetization.
Right, right. Anyway, we're going to play that clip in just a second right now, okay? So listen closely.
I believe very strongly that for countries like the United States, we could and should move to a digital currency and get rid of currency. And I have a paper, an NBR paper, coming out on digitalizing electronic money so that you would have the ability to trace this kind of corruption. There are important issues of privacy and issues of cyber security, but it would have certainly very big advantages. And I think you could attack some of the cyber issues because of the transparency. The other point is on Trump. Just if I recall correctly, he actually opposed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act because he said, you know, it's one of the dimensions in which you compete is by corruption. I think that represents exactly the kind of stance that we should be against, as so many of his other stances, and that this is not the way to do business.
What did you get out of that? What did you think about that?
Okay, so Donald Trump had made a comment that basically that's the way it is. That's the way things. Well, we may not like it in the United States, you know, whatever, but he's saying that's the way the world works, right?
Yeah, but here's what the deal is, the gist of it, is that Stiglitz is pushing a cashless society. That's ultimate control by the government of the individual. Where they don't have cash, they can't do cash transactions. Thus, everything goes into the bank account, and they can...
Well, that wasn't... No offense, but he did not use the word cashless. He said a currency, no currency.
Well, that cashless is what we're using to describe this, what he's saying.
Not demonetization?
Yeah. Well, okay. No, it's cashless, no cash. No currency, no cash in your hands. Meaning that every transaction will be scrutinized by the government then through your bank account. Okay?
Until the grid goes down, then we're all jacked.
Yeah, that way they can look at everything that you're doing, and you don't have any means to be free about your spending patterns and so forth. Okay? Now, I'm just against this totally, and it's a way of slavery. A cashless society is the way, and I think Trump knows that. That's why he didn't support the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which embedded in that act is moving us towards a cashless society. Okay. Now coming up next, we've got a clip from Blackwater founder, okay, Eric Prince, and he tries to give us a. He's on Bloomberg being interviewed, and a clip comes from an interview there, and he tried to bring us a solution to this African immigration problem by using some of the bases in southern Libya that had been closed down. But anyway, we're going to bring that up here in just a second.
Almost as enduring. As Washington deployed troops to both countries more than 10 years ago, Blackwater never seemed far behind. But the defense contractor's guards seem to play by a different rulebook, making them wildly reviled as reckless and violent mercenaries.
I disagree with the assertion that they acted like cowboys.
Their leader, former U.S. Navy SEAL Eric Prince, defended their reputation, but his image was already chained to both wars. That has sent millions running from their homes, bursting into Europe's migrant crisis. Well, now, Prince has his own ideas on solving that. He doesn't want people plucked out of the Mediterranean Sea. His blueprint in the Financial Times has armed guards on patrol, surveillance planes, quick reaction forces, and medical evacuations, with private contractors there every step of the way. When I put that to Prince himself, though, he told me to back up.
Let me back you up. Maybe we start again. I think that's an inaccurate characterization of the article.
You tell me what you think is an accurate characterization.
So the way the European Union is trying to stop the refugee crisis now is with boats that pick up the refugees once they've got the water. So these people that have paid a lot of money to be carried all the way across the Sahel, across Libya, make it to the water, and now the European Union just makes their transit that much safer. And pick them up. And because of the law of the sea, if they pick up the refugees, now they have to be taken to European landfall. The answer is to stop the refugee crisis at the southern border of Libya. Gaddafi built a lot of runways all over the country. So reopening one of those runways and making it a border security base where Libyans are trained and equipped and led, okay, the contractor or the foreign element comes in because they are basically the skeletal system that the body of a Libyan border police grows on. You provide the leadership, communications, intelligence, medical, and logistics support to that unit, and they can stop the refugees. Because the people are not walking. They have to drive. The distances, I mean, Libya is the size of Alaska. So they have to drive. Very easy for an ISR, a simple surveillance aircraft, to find those vehicles, a helicopter to interdict them from the air. That means stop and arrest. The refugees are then held at one of the refugee camps in the south, and they can be repatriated, but they don't get the ticket to Europe. That's how to stop the refugee crisis, because now the European navies are making the most difficult part of the passage the easiest and the safest.
Let me put this to you. This is, I would argue, or many would argue, a humanitarian crisis and or catastrophe, not a security issue. Given the reputation Blackwater had in Afghanistan and in Iraq, your reputation, do you risk creating a monster here in the Mediterranean and in a country, as you rightly point out, that is as big as Alaska?
Well, in Afghanistan, for example, we built the Afghan border police. We trained almost 15,000 Afghan police to do their jobs. Took them from no training to being able to patrol and communicate and to do their jobs well. I'd say one of the highest honors was that members from that unit were highly sought by U.S. or NATO units to patrol with them, because the men were switched on. They were disciplined with their tactics, techniques, and procedures. Mm. So if you replicate that in Libya, yes, you'd have contractors there or professionals, or if the Europeans want to send their personnel into southern Libya, that becomes more of a political issue. So the contractor or whoever the professional is that trains the locals is building local capacity. This can be solved by Libyans in the south of Libya, not by European navies on the Mediterranean.
Mr. Prince, given the legacy of the work that Blackwater did in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and the issues that were fleshed out by some of those involved with the company, do you have any regrets about the work there?
I have great regrets for ever going to work for the State Department. We did exactly the mission they asked us to do. We did more than 100,000 missions. No one under our care was ever killed or injured. And the men used their firearms in less than 0.5% of all those missions while doing the most dangerous personal security detail missions in the world. 41 of our men were killed in action. I regret ever working for the State Department because they were just not worth it for the men that were killed or injured doing that job.
It wasn't the way you conducted the mission, though.
We did it exactly the way they told us to. Exactly the rules of engagement, exactly per their 1,000-page contract that we bid on and won and performed.
You wrote proudly about your work in Afghanistan, asserting it proves that governments can depend on you. But listen to this American lawmaker.
As to Blackwater Paravan, their personnel engaged in reckless use of weapons. They violated the command's rules regarding to obtaining and carrying weapons.
In Libya, you're going to find a very big mess in what is essentially a total political vacuum. How does your new plan, how is it informed by the lessons that you've learned from the past?
Certainly, when you employ people, some people make mistakes, just like we used to employ turbine engines. And a turbine engine only has two moving parts, and they break as well. So if you employ thousands of people, some people make mistakes, just like you could read Inspector General reports from the Marine Corps or the Army or NATO or all the rest. When you employ thousands of people in a difficult place, some people do stupid things, and they should be accountable for that. However, the situation that remains in Libya is one of total chaos, where you have 6 million people largely afraid to go out of their homes or are struggling to survive, while it serves as a conduit for refugee flow coming out of Africa, out of everywhere else, approaching the shores of Europe. So how are you going to stop that flow? I wrote that op-ed as a way to say this is not a logistics issue. This is very possible. I spelled out how to do it. It's a matter of political will. I don't see the European countries being able to or wanting to send any capability to solve that flow, and a spontaneous order is not going to suddenly spring up from Libya without some help.
You reportedly groused that Barack Obama crushed your business, whereas I can only imagine that you think that America's next president, Mr. Donald Trump, would do the opposite. Himself, like you, a billionaire businessman. Will Trump be good for your fortunes? What are you expecting?
Let me clarify that misperception. I'm far from a billionaire. Look, I think the next administration, the United States has spent $9 trillion on defense since 9/11. And there's more places on fire around the world than ever before. I think the Pentagon has proven how to wage war in the most expensive way possible. So I, as a taxpayer, would like some fiduciary responsibility for the next administration to say, how do we do this cheaper, better, and faster, letting the private sector compete and providing that benchmark is essential. So, I mean, look, the company I'm running now, Frontier Service Group, it's not Blackwater at all. None of our men are armed. We do logistics. We deliver groceries, including frozen groceries, from Cape Town and Durban all the way up through the Democratic Republic of Congo. We do aviation out of Malta, and we are the biggest medevac provider for the UN. So our planes fly in and pull out UN peacekeepers. It is not a defense contractor at all. We're a logistics contractor, but we do it in the most difficult and interesting and challenging places.
Just briefly, is Libya an opportunity for a very quick win for a new Trump administration? And are you aware that this is a priority in his new foreign policy file?
I am not aware that it's a priority, but yes, I think with some smart diplomacy, a unifying leader can be brought in. And I think the by and large, the Libyan people are tired of war. They've been at this for 5 years. The country is in bad shape. And it should be a quick win for the Trump administration.
Okay, Charlotte, man, what do you think about that solution that Eric Prince is proposing for the African, the Libyan thing?
Well, first off, I'd like to say what a great public speaker he is. He's pretty.
He's smooth, isn't he? Yeah, he is smooth.
Yeah, you know, and you can't, I'll tell you what, when I found out about Blackwater, you know, it made my skin crawl, and I was so concerned about habeas corpus and possibilitatis and all kinds of runaway mercenary armies, you know.
Yeah.
I really entertained that quite. But no, he seems, I don't know, George. I'm not there. I've not been to Libya, and everything I'm being told on the news and what I seem to be gathering, you know, like what the Clintons did to Libya and Obama allowed and the way it all happened, you know, and the whole Iraq war. I mean, we're at a crossroads in this country, you know, and we're going to have to come together somehow and figure this out. I do not want to see military intervention there.
Right, right. Well, he's just proposing that the problem with the immigration is someone is behind the financing of these people to get them into Europe, okay? And
yeah.
We've always thought that it came from the highest level of the Bilderberg Group, the movers and shakers of Europe and America, and they're creating an amalgamation of people in Europe, and then they're going to have to maybe have a European police force, you know what I mean, Union police force or something to address the problem, and then they'll consolidate all of that into one thing. Something like that is where we're headed on this, and it doesn't look good to me, you know what I mean? And,
What about Ominous Parallels?
Yes.
That book from years back. Do you see any of that build up here, you know?
Well, I think it applies more to what we're going to discuss about the color revolutions towards the end of the program. Okay. But yeah, as far as Europe goes, you've got fascism that is in the background all the time, but it's a corporate financial fascism, okay? And so that's a good point you make there, but it's more applicable in today's world right here in America, but we'll talk about that in a second. Our next subject and topic is Anat Admonte, and she's a professor at Stanford. And she was invited to the World Economic Forum twice, once in 2014, invited back to 2015. I heard her interviews on the panel discussions live in 2015, invited her onto our program, and we have up now on the third hour tonight an interview with her, a rebroadcast, and then I did interview a little short 10-minute interview with her also yesterday that we put up. But anyway, she's talking at a TED talk, Stanford, and she's talking about the real problems of the banking industry, and she's really, really, involved in trying to find a solution. She's written, The Bankers Have No Clothes, you know, and she's really a sharp cookie, and we're going to play, her clip here in just a second. That's coming up. But it's a talk that she gave at TED Talk at Stanford, and that's coming up right now.
Five and a half years ago, around the time of the financial crisis, I started looking into banking, and I fell in a rabbit hole. Like in Alice in Wonderland, you know, where things are curiouser and curiouser like that. At first I thought, maybe I'm missing something, maybe I'm not understanding. Then I thought, it's just a big misunderstanding. We're going to talk it over. We're going to figure it out. And then the plot thickened. Let me take you to the rabbit hole of banking. First, we have to talk a little bit about debt and leverage. Here's Kate. She has a $400,000 house and $380,000 in mortgage debt. Her equity part is $20,000, about 5% of the value of the house. Now think of this as her investment. What happens if the value of the house goes up by a little bit, just 2.5%? Ah, nice. She made $10,000 on her $20,000 of investment. Nice return, huh? What if the house goes up by just 5%? Ah, she doubled her investment. How wonderful it worked for her. And if the house goes up by just 10%, she tripled her investment of $20,000 up to $60,000. All this profit is hers. That's what happens when you use a lot of debt. It magnifies, it gives you leverage, and that's really great on the upside. But there is a catch. What if the house goes down in value by just a little bit, just 2.5%? Ooh, now she lost half of her equity. And should the house go down by 5%, her equity is wiped out. If it continues downward, the house goes down by 10% from the start, she's what's called underwater. She owes more on her house than the house is worth. So that's how it can happen. Now let's talk about banks. How do banks get money to invest? Their first source is all of us. We lend them money in deposits. We sometimes forget that. But that's their debt. They owe us back that money. In fact, we expect this money to be paid anytime we want. Go to the ATM of the bank. It's supposed to be there. How else do banks get money? Oh, they find many, many, many ways to borrow, to make promises to pay back and get money in exchange. From money market funds, from each other, from bond investors, they get a lot of money by way of taking on debt. But they don't put it under the mattress, do they? We want them to lend, they want to invest, they want to take risk. And what happens if they lose? How can they pay all that debt? Better have some money from their shareholders and owners, some equity. Say 5% like Kate had in the beginning. But the banks all invest in the same things. And in fact, they are very tied up by investing in one another. And so here's what can happen when the bank loses money. Here's what did happen when banks lost money. Watch it. They all tend to fail at the same time and take each other down with them. And uh-oh, we cannot have this system fail. So let's prop it up. Let's use taxpayer money. Is Uncle Sam saving the banking system, bailing out using taxpayer money? That's what happened. Now let's ask, how do other companies get their money to invest? There's a little bit of a different pattern of colors. You know of Google. Here's how Google gets money to invest. Most of the money they get is from their shareholders and owners. They take their profits, reinvest them, unborrowed money that can be used to take risk, no problem. What about other companies? Average Corp USA has 70% equity, some debt, some companies borrow more than others, but importantly, almost no healthy company, unless it's on its way to bankruptcy, maintains on a regular basis less than 30% equity. And if they did, if they became heavily indebted, all kinds of things would start happening. Their lenders are going to charge them large interest. They're going to put all kinds of conditions on them. The banks are very good at putting tough conditions on indebted borrowers. We know that. So why are the banks so different? Why are they so different? I'll give you the answer. Because it works for them. Basically, the more reckless they are in that particular way, the more actually subsidies they get, bonuses they get, the upside is wonderful. And the downside is not so bad for them. That's why they're different, really. So, of course, they have very flawed incentives to take on risk and too much debt. And we got to counter that. In fact, we know we have a financial crisis, and lots of people got harmed from that. So we were promised there are going to be tough regulations. Tough regulations. And what did we get? Here's what we got. In Basel, in Switzerland, 27 countries negotiated the tough new reforms called Basel III. They agreed that banks should have at least 3%. 3% equity, the green stuff, relative to the total. 3%. In the U.S., they went tough on the large banks. Tough. 5%, like Kate had. 5% of the total investment has to be funded with equity and not debt. If there are insured deposits involved, 6%. Remember, no company that is living, large company, has access to its own profits to equity, lives on less than 30% equity. And when they fail, they don't take down the economy with them. And the banks, the ones that harm, are able to live like that. And if you want to take another stock of what's going on, Here are the largest banks in the world, those too big to fail banks. These are the top 28 banks in the universe by the size of their assets, by the flag of where they come from. This was 2006, 2 years before the financial crisis. And we had a crisis since then and supposedly tough reforms. And where are they today? Bigger. Average size in 2006 was $1.3 trillion. Average size today, $1.7 trillion. There are no such corporations in the world. No corporations is as big as these monstrous institutions. They are big. And, importantly, by every measure, incredibly knotted up. In ways we don't even see, in markets we don't even see very well, all kinds of markets in which they interact with one another, such that, once again, a small loss can take a chain reaction and take an entire economy down. So what's going on? I started by saying something about Alice in Wonderland and the rabbit hole, but the story that really fits is the Emperor's New Clothes story. That's a wonderful tale. In this tale, these self-declared tailors tell the emperor that they make very special clothes, beautiful and very unique in that they can only be seen by people who are smart enough, competent enough. If you can't see them, you must be stupid or unfit for your job. And the emperor buys the clothes and gives them lots of money and lots of fabrics, which they put away, and then they pretend to sew the clothes, and the ministers and the emperor just adore those clothes. And the emperor then goes on a parade in the street with these new clothes. And everybody admires the clothes except for the little boy who says, "Hey, the emperor is naked." In banking, there are lots of people who say lots of things. The bankers say lots of things. The policymakers, regulators, politicians say lots of things. A lot of banking experts say lots of things. Academics say lots of things. And a disturbing proportion of what they say has as much substance as the emperor's new clothes. Let me give you just a couple of examples, just a glimpse. You might read in the newspapers, U.S. banks are forced to hold $68 billion in extra capital. Here's how it starts. Let's use a really confusing language that nobody can understand. Hold capital. Now, what does that mean? Well, in banking, hold capital means use equity funding, unborrowed money. But hold capital, it sounds like a pile of cash that you don't use, hold $68 billion. That's the Financial Times headline. A paper trying to be a little friendlier to the readers, because maybe most people actually don't understand what this word capital means in banking, replaces the same headline with the word cash. Now, there's a word we understand. U.S. banks forced to hold $68 billion in cash. Now, that sounds tough, but it sounds like it's a pile of cash they were told to set aside somehow and not use. Guess what? This is just false. False. This is not what this is about. This particular headline refers to the requirement that banks have 5% equity to the total. Nobody's telling the banks what to do with their money. This is just telling them to use unborrowed money to invest equity funding. But this confusion that's pervasive and insidious is very convenient for the bank lobbyists. Because the bank lobbyist is going to say every dollar in capital is a dollar not put in the economy. Don't increase those capital requirements, whatever they are, because the economy will suffer and we won't lend and growth will suffer and recovery will suffer. Scares the politicians who have no idea what this is really about or maybe don't want to know. This is nonsense, total nonsense. So people might not understand what it's saying, but it's false. And it goes on from there, a whole wardrobe of these things that they say, all the way to just the spin. The spin is there was panic in 2008. It was like a natural disaster. And we rushed to the scenes, and we helped, and we propped up this system, and we did it just for you. And it would have been worse otherwise. Let's focus on that. And now we need to recover. We're doing everything to recover. We're doing it just for you. This way, we don't have to discuss how the awful regulations that they had before the crisis that allowed all this risk to build up were flawed and how they're failing with the new regulations since. So, what's going on here and how you can see that they're all kind of lying to you is the following. Here's your disconnect. The banks are saying, oh, if you put these capital requirements on us, we can't lend. Remember, the capital requirements are just about how much green versus red they have on their in their building. But here, when they make money, which most companies use as a great source of investment funding, they rush to pay it back out. Here's money they could have lent and satisfied the capital requirements just fine. Instead, they pay it out so that they can borrow and live on the edge a little bit more. So that's after they complain that they can't lend, and they could have perfectly well used their profits instead of paying them out. And the regulators? The regulators have perfect authority to say, you know, why don't you keep that green money? Just do anything but pay it out. Build up your green, the green part of your building, of your balance sheet, so that you're safer, so that you can keep investing and protect your creditors and invest on behalf of your shareholders like other companies. So among the most no-brainer bargains in financial reform that we just totally messed up is the idea that instead of 5%, banks should have what's minimal, 20 to 30%. Everything you can think about the safer bank is better, except for very few people who prefer the riskier bank. Everything is better. They can do everything. They can make the loans. They can make it more consistently, take deposits, everything. But yet, we're not getting it. So what's going on? How is the plot thickening? Well, it's about what people know, but it's also about what people want to know. On this, Upton Sinclair said the following: you can't teach a man something if his salary depends on not understanding it. So there's what's called willful blindness. You might not understand, but you might not want to understand. I got my story. I'm sticking to it. You can make lots of variations on this particular sentence. For example, could you get a politician to engage or to understand something if they got campaign contributions on the line? Could you get a regulator to engage if they got all kinds of incentives to avoid engaging, really, or to avoid challenging the banker? Can you get even a reporter or a journalist to challenge a policymaker or a banker or anybody expert if they need a story from these people, if they need the phone call return? Everybody's got their issue about challenging. So just like in the emperor's new clothes, do you challenge the emperor, do you challenge the ministers, or do you play along? Do you say, oh, little boy, you don't see those beautiful clothes when you grow up. You're going to see the beautiful clothes of the emperor. How do you handle that situation? The real politics comes from this statement by Senator Richard Durbin from 2009, right after the financial crisis. Banks are still the biggest lobby in Washington, and they frankly own the place. So in other countries too, there is often a symbiosis between banks and governments, between bankers and politicians. And there's where the plot gets thick. So now, here we are. We might only pay attention to the financial system in a major crisis, so we're dealing with other things. Meanwhile, we have a really bad system. Reckless system, out of control, very dangerous, not much has changed. Can we have a better system? We can, but unfortunately, if you leave it to the people doing it right now, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So we can have a better system, but we must demand a better system. And that's why I need you to help me scream. Thank you.
Charlotte, man, I'll tell you, that was quite a speech, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
I mean, this woman, I really like her, you know. And I called her when she was over in Switzerland the last time in 2015. And then later on, after she came back from Switzerland, we had this interview, you know, with her. But she described it in pretty simple terms. And I believe some of the points that she was making, one of the main points is that corporations conduct their business with an equity of about 30%, 20 to 30% or more. She said the bank should try to get up there to that same operating level and not try to get leveraged out like they are with 3 to 5% equity. And then if something happens, then their equity is wiped out and the stockholders are gone. See what I mean? And so She'd been going over to World Economic Forum in 2014 and 15, but she hadn't been invited back because they don't want to hear it. I've watched her on the panel discussions, and all these other bankers and stuff and financial people, they don't want to hear what she has to say because it's gotten worse from 2008 to now.
Well, she makes a very convincing argument, that's for sure, that they talk in techno speak, you know.
Yeah,
and,
I know.
And
yeah.
When you get behind the actions, the motivations, the principles behind what people are doing, no matter what language they put it under or decorate it with or designed to confuse you and to mislead and to further, you know.
Exactly. And the bankers talk in this double talk, highly technical banking accounting form. You know what I mean? And the average person just doesn't get it. You know, but the banks are out of control, like she said. They're too over leveraged, and they don't have the equity they need for safe banking or even business practices, is what she's saying. And anyway, she's a stand up lady. And okay, coming up next, we've got Tulsi Gabbard that went over on a secret mission to Syria, and. She went along with her with Dennis Kucinich, and we're going to play that clip next. And the interview is just fascinating because listen closely to what she's advising us to do concerning the Syrian question, and that'll coming up right now.
Welcome back to Lead Our World Lead Now, a desperate plea for help. 7-year-old Bana Alabed has become the face of innocent civilian suffering in Syria's deadly civil war. The young girl is now safely living in Turkey with her family. But earlier today, she tweeted a message to President Trump, quote, "I beg you, can you do something for the children of Syria? If you can, I will be your best friend. Thank you." Unquote. This comes as a fragile ceasefire between Syrian government forces and rebel factions is holding for now. Joining me now in a CNN exclusive is Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii. She just returned from a secret trip to Syria. Congresswoman Gabbard, thanks for coming and sharing your story with us.
Aloha, Jake. Good to be with you.
So you were in Syria for 4 days. Did you meet with President Bashar al-Assad?
I did. You know, my reason for going to visit Syria was really because of the suffering of the Syrian people that has been weighing heavily on my heart. I wanted to see if there was, in some small way, a way that I could express the love and the aloha and the care that the American people have for the people of Syria, and to see firsthand what was happening there, to see that situation there.
What did Assad have to say?
Initially, I hadn't planned on meeting him. When the opportunity arose to meet with him, I did so because I felt it's important that if we profess to truly care about the Syrian people, about their suffering, then we've got to be able to meet with anyone that we need to if there is a possibility that we could achieve peace. And that's exactly what we talked about.
Now, I know the maxim that people say in the military that you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. But obviously Bashar al-Assad is responsible for thousands of deaths and millions of people being displaced during this 5-year-long civil war. Did you have any compunctions about meeting with somebody like that, giving him any sort of enhanced credibility because a member of the United States Congress would meet with someone like that?
Whatever you think about President Assad, the fact is that he is the president of Syria. In order for any peace agreement, in order for any possibility of a viable peace agreement to occur, there has to be a conversation with him. The Syrian people will determine his outcome and what happens with their government and their future. But our focus, my commitment is on ending this war that has caused so much suffering to these Syrian people, to these children, to these families, many of whom I met on this trip. It's important for us to stay focused on doing what is in their best interest and what is in our best interest, and doing what it is necessary to make that happen.
So, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, a friend of yours, also a military veteran, a Republican, he said on Twitter when he heard about your visit, quote, "Fact-finding mission, fact, 50,000 plus dead children in Syria. Tulsi Gabbard, I hope you didn't meet with their butcher, Assad." Now, Assad has used chemical weapons on his own people. You said it's going to be up to the Syrian people, but there really aren't free and fair elections in Syria.
I'll tell you what I heard from the Syrian people that I met with, Jake, walking down the streets in Aleppo, in Damascus, hearing from them. They expressed happiness and joy at seeing an American walking through their streets. But they expressed a question. They said, why is it that the United States, its allies and other countries are providing support, are providing arms to terrorist groups like al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, Ahrar al-Sham, ISIS, who are on the ground there raping, kidnapping, torturing, and killing the Syrian people, children, men, women, people of all ages. They asked me, why is the United States and its allies supporting these terrorist groups who are destroying Syria when it was al-Qaeda who attacked the United States on 9/11, not Syria? I didn't have an answer for them.
Obviously, the United States government denies providing any sort of help to the terrorist groups that you're talking about. They say they provide help for the rebel groups. Tell us more about
the reality is, Jake. Yeah. The reality is, and I'm glad you brought up that point, because this is an often talked about thing by people like Adam Kinzinger and others, saying, well, we've got to support the moderate rebels. Every place that I went, every person that I spoke to, I asked this question to them. And without hesitation, they said, there are no moderate rebels. Who are these moderate rebels that people keep speaking of? Regardless of the name of these groups, the strongest fighting force on the ground in Syria is al-Nusra, or al-Qaeda and ISIS. That is a fact. There's a number of different other groups. All of them essentially are fighting alongside, with, or under the command of the strongest group on the ground that's trying to overthrow Assad. The Syrian people recognize, and they know, that if President Assad is overthrown, then al-Qaeda or a group like al-Qaeda that has been killing Christians, killing people simply because of their religion or because they won't support their terror activities, they will take charge of all of Syria. This is the reality that the people of Syria are facing on the ground, and why they are pleading with us here in the United States to stop supporting these terrorist groups. Let the Syrian people themselves determine their future, not the United States, not some foreign country.
And we've been showing video of your trip, from your trip. In the minute we have left, tell us the most striking image you have from your visit to this war-torn region.
Yeah, Jake, you know, the destruction is very real, both on the physical buildings and the things that people have gone through, looking into their eyes and hearing firsthand from a girl who is now 19, but who, when she was 14 years old, these rebels that people say we should continue supporting, they came and kidnapped her. They raped her multiple times. They killed her father in cold blood right in front of her and her little brother. All she is asking for, literally, is for the United States to stop supporting these so-called rebel groups, stop supporting these terrorists, so that the Syrian people can begin to try to get back to some semblance of normalcy in their lives.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Democrat of Hawaii, thank you so much. We appreciate your coming and telling us the story.
Thanks, Jake.
Charlotte, that's quite a story, isn't it? Huh?
Yeah, I hope she comes out with some more information. I could see where, you know, both sides on this. It's concerning. It's very concerning, you know?
Right. Well, you know, over the years, they've made Assad into the bad guy. And it's been proven time and time again that we went in there and started supporting their so-called rebel movement. And we shouldn't have been there at all, as far as I'm concerned. And also, there have been thousands of people uprooted and had to leave Syria. There were all kinds of people killed and murdered and everything by what's going on. And it's just become just a tragic mess. And, you know, Gabbard is actually a Democrat. She's a representative from Hawaii, but she's on the Democratic side. So what she says has some weight to it, I would think.
Oh, in a situation like this, I don't discount either side's sincerity.
Yeah.
Of their perspective. Right. But we can't listen to 7-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And children. We have to listen to the adults on the ground, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point. Now, coming up next, we've got something that goes back to 2003, in fact, and it's about Wesley Clark and his experiences in the Pentagon. And what we're tying here together tonight is a lot of differing, maybe it sounds like they're disconnected, but when you start tying the Blackwater in with the immigration coming in from the southern Libya, and you're looking at banking problems, and you're looking at cashless societies, and then you're looking at Gabbard, what she said, over, and then you're seeing a big money system, see, behind the scenes on some of the going-ons, and it's just really an evil system, and we're painting a picture like that, and we're going to end with Nikki Haley on our next clip, but right now we're going to play a little over 2 minutes and 13 seconds of General Wesley Clark and his experiences in the Pentagon in 2003.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years. Starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you. But there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
Well, but Charlotte, that was something else, wasn't it, huh?
Yes, that sure was. Very telling. I thought it was interesting that when he was saying that, not to critique it too much, but when he was telling the truth to the room,
right,
they
right.
laughed. They took it as a joke. They took it. They actually, their knee-jerk reaction was laughter.
Right.
When he
right.
said that, you know, "We're going to war." Now I get it. I understand why that laughter happened, but it's also disheartening and kind of concerning because it was very real compared
right.
to where we stand at today in hindsight.
Well, you know, we're in Syria because of that plan that he uncovered in the Pentagon. See, that's the problem with this, is that there's been a plan to take down some of those Arab countries. We call it Arab Spring or something, you know what I mean? But it has been going on, and it's ongoing, and Syria, it was a target.
See? Wow.
And so we're painting a picture tonight, and our listening audience is clued in on many of these issues and topics already. So in a way, we're singing to part of our listening audience. We're singing to a choir here, or preaching to a choir. But the other part of new people coming in, we're beginning to put this thing together in a synergistic way, I hope, that is halfway understandable. See what I mean? And that's really what we've been doing tonight. And I want to get this last clip played before we run out of time tonight on our broadcast. And what it is, basically, it's Nikki Haley. She's the American ambassador to the UN. And she's talking in a very condemnatory way about Russia. And she's speaking for the first time to the Security Council. And so we're going to play that right now.
This is my first appearance in this chamber as the permanent representative of the United States. It is an immense honor for me to sit behind the United States placard and to follow in the footsteps of so many giants of American diplomacy. It is humbling to be part of a body whose responsibility is nothing less than maintaining international peace and security. I look forward to working closely with each of you on this council. The United States is determined to push for action. There is no time to waste. I consider it unfortunate that the occasion of my first appearance here is one in which I must condemn the aggressive actions of Russia. It is unfortunate because it is a replay of far too many instances over many years in which United States representatives have needed to do that. It should not have to be that way. We do want to better our relations with Russia. However, the dire situation in eastern Ukraine is one that demands clear and strong condemnation of Russian actions. The sudden increase in fighting in eastern Ukraine has trapped thousands of civilians and destroyed vital infrastructure. And the crisis is spreading, endangering many thousands more. This escalation of violence must stop. The United States stands with the people of Ukraine, who have suffered for nearly 3 years under Russian occupation and military intervention. Until Russia and the separatists it supports respect Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, this crisis will continue. Eastern Ukraine, of course, is not the only part of the country suffering because of Russia's aggressive actions. The United States continues to condemn and call for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea. Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine. The basic principle of this United Nations is that states should live side by side in peace. There is a clear path to restoring peace in eastern Ukraine, full and immediate implementation of the Minsk agreements, which the United States continues to support. For the people in eastern Ukraine, the stakes are high. With each passing day, more people are at risk of freezing to death or dying from a mortar blast. The United States calls on Russia and the combined Russian separatist forces to fulfill their commitments in the Minsk agreements and fully restore and respect the ceasefire. The Minsk agreements require the disengagement of forces and withdrawal of heavy weapons from both sides of the contact line. This is the formula for a sustainable ceasefire. Pulling back forces and taking heavy weapons out of this area will save lives. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Special Monitoring Mission must also be granted full, unfettered access. The presence of OSCE monitors can help calm tensions. Cooperation on this issue is possible. Earlier this week, both Russia and Ukraine supported this council's unanimous call to return to a ceasefire. It was the first time in years that this council was able to come together on Ukraine. The parties on the ground should heed this signal and hold their fire. The United States expects that those who can influence the groups that are fighting, in particular Russia, will do everything possible to support an end to this escalation of violence. Thank you.
Well, there you go, Charlotte. That's our new ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley. She's a former governor of South Carolina, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so she made some statements there that are not even halfway feasible. I mean, about the Crimean, tying that to the sanctions, and the Russians have to, give back the Crimean Peninsula to the Ukraine before any sanctions are taken off. Well, that's not going to happen, see? But I just don't know what the point I want to make on this is that right now the foreign policy of the Trump administration, I think, is a little bit jumbled. See, I'm getting cross current types of statements and policy statements that are not consistent with a good viable concerted foreign policy. What are your thoughts, Charlotte?
Oh, well, I think that's very good insight, George. I thought she sounded like somebody in psychological operations wrote her speech.
I know, because it was too aggressive. Well, let me tell you what she said to her first address to the General Assembly. She said, we're taking names and kicking, you know what? I mean, she didn't say that, but she said that if you're not in agreement with us and willing to go along with some of us, we're going to take names. See what I mean? I mean, that's not language that you use at the United Nations. I don't care who you are. I mean, if you're halfway a diplomat, you know what I'm trying to say?
She's a little too cowboy.
What's that?
She's a little too cowboy.
Yeah. She's acting too aggressive here at too early. You know what I mean? And making demands of Russia that aren't going to even happen anyway. And then before that, at the general, her first, you know what I mean, a speech to the General Assembly or address to the General Assembly, she's demanding and taking names. That's not the way to do. You know what I mean?
What's her background in? Is she criminal justice background?
No, she's governor of South Carolina, governor.
What's your... Governor?
Yeah.
But what'd she do before that? Flower arrangements? I mean, who is she?
No, she's had a legal background. She's got quite an education. And, but I mean, she's actually Indian. Her parents are Indian. And, then, her political stuff, comes out of, she's a Republican. Oh, I know what. She has close ties to Romney, okay? And Romney has close ties to Netanyahu, okay? So what she's expressing is an Israeli view of the Russians and continued sanctions against the Russians, and because they don't like them being in Syria. See, the Israelis don't want the Russians in there helping the Syrians, okay?
Well, Russia has its own objectives and goals and its own independent objectives outside of United States, Russia, and Syria. I mean, they are the snake in the grass, if you ask me.
Right.
And that she could just be a shrill for Israel.
Well, it looks like that's a case because she's got close ties to Romney, and that Romney's tied into Netanyahu. Well, I'll tell you what. Do you have any final statements, Charlotte? We've just got about a minute to go here, and do you have any final and closing comment tonight?
I just wanted to thank you for having me join you today, George, in February, 2016. We've been at this a long time, and I enjoy it every time. Thanks.
Well, one of the things that we didn't get to tonight, we were going to get into the color revolutions
and
bring Soros in there and all that, but we're out of time. We only have about a minute to go. But I'll briefly want to make a short statement here. And the problem with this thing is that the groups that are out there, that are, using the word fascism against Trump are being used. And they're being used by the very fascists, the financial fascists that are over everybody and that have been manipulating the left and the right against each other. So, but I don't think they're going to wake up to this. But that's basically what's going on is that the ultra capitalists, the people at the very top of this money power pyramid are utilizing these young people and then mounting an offense and an attack against Trump. And they're using the symbol of fascism. And it's so tragic. Well, look, Charlotte, thanks for being with me this evening. Boy, you made some good comments. And tell you what, we'll come back next Saturday night, 7 to 9 every Saturday night on 89.1. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thanks, George.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye.